Six Music.
BBC Radio Six Music Documentaries.
The image of Alice Cooper as a cartoonish Halloween rocker is one that the 63-year-old Vincent Damon Fernier has worked hard to establish, but his real musical and cultural impact is often ignored. His band emerged from the Detroit garage rock scene in the mid-60s alongside the MC5 and Iggy and the Stooges, and can lay claim to helping inspire punk music as much as either of those acts. It's no coincidence that his track 18 was sung by Johnny Rotten at his audition for the Sex Pistols. But Alice Cooper was also the first musician to approach rock concerts as theatre, introducing horror imagery and stagecraft way before David Bowie picked up the pan stick. Here I speak to Alice about his early years, how he developed his showmanship, about the massive international success that followed albums like Welcome to My Nightmare and songs like School's Out and Elected, which you just heard there. With typical grace and humour, Alice also discusses his battles with alcoholism, his creative rebirth with his legendary cameo in Wayne's World, and of course we talk about his ongoing overriding addiction, golf. I'm very pleased to say my guest this week is Alice Cooper. The first question in this series is always, when were you first aware of music as a child?
Good. I grew up in Detroit with Motown. So the first music the first time I was really aware of something I really liked, my uncle brought me a Chuck Berry record. And it was, Up in the Morning and Out to School.
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical man. You study him hard and hoping to pass. Working your fingers right down to the bone. And the guy behind you won't leave you alone. Ring, ring goes the bell. The cook in the lunchroom's ready to sell. You're lucky if you can find a seat. You're fortunate if you have time to eat. Back in the classroom, open your books. Gee, but the teacher don't know how mean she looks. Soon as 3 o'clock rolls around, you finally lay your burden down. Close up your books, get out of your seat. Down the halls and into the street. Up to the corner and round the bend. You go in, drop the coin right into the slot. You gotta hear something that's really hot. With the one you love, you're making romance. All day long you've been wanting to dance. Feeling the music from head to toe. Round and round and round you go.
And it was like this, you know. I was in it already. I was like 6 years old.
Straight away.
Yeah, because it had the 4-4 for beat. And you were already into it. Now, my dad liked big band. He liked Sinatra and everybody. So, of course, that was around. But the first time I ever really, my ears perked up, I think, was Chuck Berry. And, of course, Elvis then was after that. I was at the beginnings of rock and roll because I was only, I grew up in Detroit, born there in 48. So middle 50s is when rock and roll started being played on the radio.
That must have been a very exciting time, because you've kind of got the big band stuff and you've got rock and roll coming through as well.
Right, and my dad liked rock and roll. So my dad, who was a Sinatra and all the 40s big band stuff, liked, you know, Chuck Berry and Elvis and all those guys. And you know, so that was not a no-no on our radio. We'd get in the car, he'd turn on rock and roll.
That's
and we'd
cool.
hear all the doo-wop stuff, you know, and that was stuff you could sing along to. You could sing along to Venus, if you will, please send a little girl for me. And those songs were so easy to like because they were 3-minute happy songs.
Kisses and my arms, a girl with all the charms of you. Venus, make her fair, a lovely girl with sunlight in her hair. And take the brightest stars up in the skies and place them in her eyes for me.
Can you remember buying your first few singles, maybe your first?
First single I ever bought with my own money was Anita Baker's Jim Dandy to the Rescue. Jim Dandy to the Rescue. When the first album I ever bought was All Summer Long, Beach Boys.
Ah, good stuff.
Yeah, I was old enough then when I was about 12, 13, where I was, you know, I'd cut somebody's lawn, I'd get $2 and I'd go and bought an album. And the first album I bought was Beach Boys, All Summer Long. I was 15. I'm painting the house in Phoenix, our house, summer morning, and I hear this song called She Loves You by this band called The Beatles. And I stopped painting and I went, what was that? Because it was something totally new. It was exciting. It was, I never saw what they looked like. Didn't matter. It was the song that got me.
And that was it. That was a heart stopping.
I just went, what was that? And then you saw a picture of the Beatles, and all of a sudden I was like hooked, just hooked on this Beatles thing. And then all the bands, like a tsunami of British bands came over, and every week there was a new band. And we would just sit there and go, did you see this band, the Kinks? Unbelievable. They have hair down to their collars, you know. We were the prime kids that was affected by the British invasion.
You know you should be glad.
you know you should be glad.
Because you've talked about your love of the Yardbirds especially. Can you remember first hearing them?
Oh, yeah. Yardbirds, first thing you heard was, dun, 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 for your love. And that was okay. You got, because you got the album, and then you heard all the other stuff, the Jeff Beck and the Eric Clapton stuff. And all of a sudden you're hearing, I'm a man. Us being a little Beatle band, went, okay, we just changed our whole thing. Now we're going to play that stuff.
What was your very first band like then?
The first band, the Earwigs, we did a sort of a comedy satire on the Beatles. And so we did a takeoff on the Beatles. We called ourselves the Earwigs. We bought the Beatle wigs. And we, you know, hired girls to come up and scream for us during the lunchtime, you know, in the cafeteria. And it was fun. Well, we were immediately affected by it. And the Earwigs started that summer, was coming along. Everybody learned to play an instrument. And by the time school started sophomore year, we were a band. We were playing parties.
So from the very first performance, it wasn't like, this is a bit of fun. It was,
well,
I want to do
it
this.
It started out being a total joke. And we were bitten immediately by being up there on stage.
When did you first become Alice? You must get asked this all the time.
Well, the first time as Alice was, the first show was, I can remember it distinctly, in Santa Barbara Fairgrounds with...
Once again, quite apt to Fairgrounds, you see?
Yeah, it was a big show, and we were the third on the bill. It was Blue Cheer, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, which was a bluegrass band, and Alice Cooper. And we were called the Naz before that. We found out that Todd Rundgren's band was called the Naz. And so we decided, we're a bit theatrical and we're a bit dark. Let's not call ourselves something like the Poisonous Dragon or whatever it was going to be. So let's go the other way. Let's give ourselves a name that sounds like what we're not. So Alice Cooper sounded like a little old lady that lived down the street that knitted and made cookies for everybody. And I said, that's perfect. Because what they're going to get is us. You know, with the makeup and the, you know, and the hair, and it's Alice Cooper. And it suddenly had a ring to it. It had a sort of ominous, dark ring to it.
So the theatrical image emerged initially quite early on in your career.
Very early. I mean, honestly, we were all art students also. So our idea was, I mean, you'd see The Who on Shindig or Hullabaloo, and you'd see these great bands, the Kinks, them. And the only thing that was missing to me as an artist was, why is it blank behind them? Why isn't anybody painting this picture? You know, and our idea was to make the lyrics come to life. Why just sing Welcome to My Nightmare? Why not give them the nightmare? And that was our niche. I mean, that was the thing that made us different, is that we would take the lyrics and bring them to life. And what does that entail? Well, that entails costuming. It would entail lighting, fog, this, that, this. So that the stage, when you saw Alice Cooper, it was like, wait till you see this. This is something, you know. And that was the beginnings of Alice being a villain, not a hero of rock, a villain of rock.
Which was pretty groundbreaking at the time, wasn't it?
It was. It was. Well, it scared most of the parents, and it scared the establishment so much that that helped us so much. There was really nothing to ban in our show. There was no bad language. There was no nudity. There was nothing, you know, in 1964. But we scared the hell out of them because they thought their kids were going to start looking like us. You know, we saw the Rolling Stones and said, we're going to make the Rolling Stones look like choir boys.
Tell me about your first deal, because there's a Frank Zappa connection there, isn't there?
A very interesting deal. You know, Frank saw us play at a club called the Cheetah Club. It was Lenny Bruce's birthday party.
That's cool.
And it was the Doors, you know, all these great bands, Buffalo Springfield, 4,000 people there, and we came on last. It was Alice Cooper. And everybody was on acid, and everybody was grooving to Peace and Love. And here comes Alice Cooper. We started out with Out in the Street by The Who. And it was black and up lights. And we're like, you know, horrific clowns up there. We cleared that room in about two songs. And the only people left standing was Frank Zappa and my manager, Shep, and a couple of the GTOs, the girls from the GTOs. And Frank went, anybody that's got enough power to clear the room like that, I want on my label. So we signed with Zappa. He was the only one that would take a chance on us. Everybody else had turned us down. We
Good
were
guy.
Just too weird for, you know, for anybody in L.A. And Zappa says, I want him.
Pick a Zappa song.
One that can be played on the radio?
Yeah, okay, we're limiting ourselves, but one that
I
can
would
play
say
on the radio.
Probably Dancing Fool.
I don't know much about dancing, that's why I got this song. One of my legs is shorter than the other and both of my feet's too long. Of course, not right along with them. I got no natural rhythm. But I go dancing every night, hoping one day I might get it right. I'm a dancing fool. I jump out of my seat, but I can't compete, cause I'm a dancing fool. Dancing fool. The disco folks all dressed up like this fit to kill. I walk on in and see them there, gonna give them all a thrill. When they see me coming, they all steps aside. He has a fit while I commit my social suicide. I'm a dancing fool. Dancing fool. I'm a dancing fool. Dancing fool. The beat goes on and I'm so wrong. The beat goes on and I'm so wrong. The beat goes on and I'm so wrong, but I'm a dancing fool. I may be totally wrong, but I'm a dancing fool.
Yowza, yowza, yowza. I got it all together now with my very own disco clothes. Hey, my shirt's half open to show you my chain and the spoon for up my nose. I am really something, that's what you'd probably say. So smoke your little smoke, drink your little drink, while I dance the night away. I'm a dancing fool. Wrong with them.
totally wrong, but I'm a. I may be totally wrong, but I'm a.
Was he a good guy to work with?
Frank was great. He was all Frank did was recorded. He had coffee in one hand, a cigarette in one hand, and he spent 22 hours a day recording. There's albums, there's probably 20 albums in the vault that haven't been released yet. But he was such a genius that you'd go over to his house and there'd be Eric Clapton and Jimi Hendrix and Mick Jagger and Marianne Faithfull. And they all kind of revolved. They all wanted to see this Frank Zappa because he was the maestro. Mm. He was the, he could actually be the conductor at the Philharmonic. And yet he was Frank Zappa. He was a musical genius. And to be in the Mothers of Invention, you had to be the best of the best. And you had to be able to read music. There's the drummer, every once in a while, got what's called the black sheet. It was a piece of paper that was had so many drum notes on it that it's called the black sheet.
You can hardly see anything, it's just notation.
If you could play the black sheet, you were in the Mothers. Ainsley Dunbar, you know, certain guys looked at the black sheet and went, wow, okay. And they play it. But I mean, if you couldn't read the black sheet, you were not in the Mothers. He was that much of a genius to all these guys. In fact, he gave Jimi Hendrix his first wah-wah pedal.
I'm 18, released November 1970. Kind of one of your first breakthrough hits.
That was it. That was the one we heard on the radio for the first time. We ever heard any of our songs on the radio.
That's a great moment.
Oh, we're in Detroit, and we're playing every weekend with Iggy and the Stooges and the MC5 and all these Detroit bands, you know, and we're all young bands trying to do something. We're playing every weekend just to eat, basically, not realizing that each one of those bands are going to go on to have a career. You know, as far as we were just local bands. And we did this song 18 with Bob Ezrin. And I said, well, you know, it's nice. It's a good song and everything. But, you know, well, look what's on the radio. The Supremes, Simon and Garfunkel, da-da-da-da. And we're driving along, and it's pick hit of the week, and they play it. And, I mean, literally, there was not a – you could hear a pin drop in the car because all the guys in the band were just – they were afraid they were hearing things. And they went, well – at least we got one play. Song went on to be number two on CKLW, which was the biggest breakout station in the world, in the United States at least. And that's when we knew something was going on. We actually had a hit record, you know.
Because that song turned out to be a massive influence on punk. John Lydon has often said, like, you know, that's one of the songs that he used to sing.
And for a band like us that were trying to be the Yardbirds, we were trying to be a complicated band, Bob Ezrin kept saying, dumb it down. And we go, what does that mean? He says, take three more chords out of that song. So it's dum dum da 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 dum 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 dum. It should have been going dum dum da 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 da. We kept going, what do you mean dumb it down? He says, it's got to be so basic. This guy's going, I'm 18 and I like it. That's the message. Not realizing that's exactly what kids wanted to hear. And it ended up being, you know, one of the biggest hits we ever had because Bob knew, make it simple and startling and not like anything else on the radio.
Lines foam on my face and hands. Lines foam from the ups and downs.
Can you remember your first tour of the UK? Because that was, people talk about it being one of the tours, like, apparently Bowie came to see you, and all these people were kind of like, oh, okay, you can do this now.
Yeah.
You remember coming over here for the first time?
It was, yeah. We came over with the controversy that we were banned.
Yeah.
You know, Leo Absey and Mary Whitehouse banned us, which was the best thing ever.
Thank you very much.
No, we sent them flowers. We sent Leo Absey cigars, and they could not figure out why we were so nice to them. They thought we were trying to butter them up. We were going, no, you understand, the more you hate us, the more the public loves us. You know, the record went right to number one. You know, we sold out Wembley. It was one of those things where we were just, this is great. We realized at that point that the British public got it. They got what Alice was about. There was humor involved in it. It was scary. It was anti-establishment, but it had a sense of humor to it.
Mm.
You know, it was there was an absurdity to it that the British public got. And we felt much more comfortable over here than we did in the States, because the States didn't get it yet. You know, it took the British to make us stars before the Americans went, oh, okay.
And it did have a massive impact on glam rock and that whole, as I mean, I mentioned Bowie. Were you a big Bowie fan?
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, we had heard of Bowie. I had never heard of Screamin' Lord Sutch. Somebody would say, well, you're just doing Screamin' Lord Sutch. And I'm going, who is that? Nobody in the States had ever heard of Screamin' Lord Sutch. You know, I mean, he was a British property that really never translated.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So, but it wasn't anything like what we were doing. I mean, we were a band. You know, we were like a force. We wanted to be the next big band, not a novelty,
mm-hmm.
You know. But again, the next day, you'd look out on the street and the kids were wearing top hats. And they were wearing black under their eyes.
You're like, yes, we have connected.
Goth had been born, you know, from Alice Cooper. And, you know, T-Rex used to come, you know, Mark Bolan came to the show and all these guys. The fact that we could have hit records and be theatrical and be show busy and be arrogant about it, it let a lot of bands come through. All of a sudden, bands were coming through going, oh, now I can do this, I can do that. And, you know, and it was born. I mean, glam rock was born.
Who would you pick from that era, if we were to play a track from that era, that kind of generation?
Well, you know, All the Young Dudes, Bowie, is the ultimate glam track, I think, will always be the ultimate glam track.
You're listening to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, here on 6 Music, and that was All the Young Dudes, a David Bowie version recorded but not released in 1973 for the sessions for his Aladdin Sane album. And that was the choice of my guest today, Alice Cooper.
6 Music. BBC 6 Music.
Welcome back to the first time here on Six Music with me, Matt Everett, and my guest today, Alice Cooper. And that was Poison, the song that marked Alice's creative comeback in about 1989. But stepping back now, it was the track Schools Out in 1972 that changed Alice's life, becoming a massive hit and setting him on the path that would eventually make him a household name. I asked him if he remembered what it was like when he first released that landmark song.
It's the only time I ever said this is a hit.
Yeah?
There was never, ever a time where I ever listened to another record of ours and went, this is a sure thing. Schools Out was a sure thing. I listened to it and I went, I can't find anything wrong with this record. It's got the kids at the end. It captures that last 3 minutes on the last day of school when you're watching the clock going, in 2 more minutes, I'm out of school for 3 months. That's in the United States. When it went, bzz, the place went crazy. The school went crazy. And I said, we got to get that on the record. And Bob Ezrin was our genius. He was the one that knew how to get that. But what we got in there was that our Yardbirds influence. That dun da 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 dun da 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 dun da 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 dun da 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 dun. You know, it had every little element. Even the guitar riff was almost like a bratty little kid going na 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 na. And it wasn't written to be that. It just ended up being the perfect riff for that song. So, you know, all the elements came together for that song.
Financially a good move then as well.
It's what we say, that's the rent payer. That's the one that pays the rent. And it's always our finale song. It's the balloons.
Yeah.
It's the top hat. It's the confetti. Everybody's, yeah. When we got no choice, all the girls and boys making all that noise, 'cause they found new toys. Well, we can't salute ya, can't find a flag. If that don't suit ya, that's a drag. Schools out for summer. Schools.
sort of reading about your history around that time, you really were perceived as being a threat to the moral sort of goodness and saintlyhood of society.
Well, we were wearing, you know, half of our girlfriend's clothes. Like, I'd wear my girlfriend's slip with a pair of black leather pants and motorcycle boots with blood all over the slip for no apparent reason. It had no, you know, and then the makeup smeared on and the hair ratted up. And people would look at us and go, what the hell are they? You know, there's no reason not to like them. And our parents hate them. So there's every reason to love these guys.
I mean, obviously on the kind of West Coast and East Coast, it would have been, you know, they would have got it. And in your hometown, they would have got it. But did you find a lot of issues with people? Don't like your way, don't like the way these boys are looking.
Exactly. We lived on it. We lived on it. Believe me, we milked it. Any time that we got that kind of press, you know, Shep, who's been our manager for 45 years, we'd go, yes. They hate you in Binghamton. There's protests outside your show.
Let's go.
Yeah, let's do it. You know, and we couldn't. That's the stuff you couldn't buy, because we got it. It was fun. Billion Dollar Babies was a joke on us. When we wrote that, we were calling ourselves Billion Dollar Babies. We're going, we're a bunch of kids doing what we like to do, and people are giving us billions of dollars to do it. What's going on? You know, what happened with our society? That we sold Billion Dollar Babies was us making fun of us, you know? And that ended up being bigger than School's Out.
How big had the show got by that point, by the Billion Dollar Babies?
Billion Dollar Babies production. Was the last big production. Now, you have to remember now, before us, there wasn't even lighting. Nobody had, you know, Very lights. So when people saw us with Very lights on, and smoke coming up out of the ground, and side lighting, and it was all went with the music, it was like something nobody had ever seen before. So you could see why they would look at Billion Dollar Babies and just go, this is amazing. You know, this is like Broadway. You know, this is like, but it's heavy. You know, it's not Broadway at all. But they've taken the best part of Broadway and attached it to what they're doing. And now, I don't know if I'm supposed to like this or not, but I really like it, you know. So it really did break down a lot of barriers, things that you could do and couldn't do on stage. That was the last big Alice show as a band. At that point then, we had been working for 7 years without a break. And I think what I saw next was Welcome to My Nightmare, which was going to dwarf Billion Dollar Babies as a production. And I think the band was looking at it as, let's take a break. Let's split the money up. And I want to do this kind of music. I want to do that kind of music. And so the band broke up, but not in a bad way. We did not break up with any lawsuits. Nobody was angry with anybody. Everybody was just kind of exhausted and kind of said, let's be separated for a while. Well, I went on to do Nightmare, which was even bigger, bolder, and everything than the Billion Dollar Babies. And it was a real gamble for me because it was me without the band. And that was my security, was the band.
It's a whole different thing on your own.
And Bob Ezrin said, let's put another band together. And that for me was weird because I'd never been in another band. These guys I went to high school with, they were my best friends. So it was an oddity, and it was a first for me to go out on my own.
How did that level of fame affect you? Because it gets to the point where you're instantly recognizable. You've had string after string. You've gone solo and still been a success, which is always one of the things that many frontmen find very difficult.
Well, and we also totally was drenched in press.
Yeah.
There was no such thing as a day when I didn't do 20 interviews.
That's a lot of work. That's a lot of pressure. It's a lot of pressure for you.
It was, but it was fun because I was this character that didn't have to answer to anybody. Whatever I said was, what are you going to do about it? You know, it was like sort of the freedom in not trying to please anybody. It was Alice Cooper. You could do anything you wanted to do. You had the total freedom to be anybody you wanted to be. So I was this, probably what Gaga is doing right now. Mm. She's in that same exact position that Alice was in, where there's no boundaries, there's no rules. Nobody can say you can't do that because she's Lady Gaga. You know, I was in the same exact position. You're indestructible at the point. And whatever you said, was, if it was controversial, it even made you bigger.
That's terrifying.
Yeah. But it was fun because honestly, we never ever thought we were ever going to get out of Phoenix. You know, the band was so outrageous, so far out on the limb that we were either going to be considered brilliant or insane. And with the hit records, that turns the corner. If you don't have those hit records, you're a puppet show. If you don't have that something to hang your hat on, you know, people would say, well, you know, they're theatrical and that's why they're this. But you go, well, wait a minute. You just had three number ones in a row. And they've got all these hit records and everything, so they're doing something right. If you don't have that, though, you're gone in a flash.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're gonna like it. I think you're gonna feel you belong. A nocturnal vacation. Necessary sedation. You wanna feel at home, 'cause you belong.
Alcohol stop becoming a problem for you?
Well, I think probably the first drink. Honestly, I had no idea that I was genetically going to be an alcoholic. I was a totally functional alcoholic. I never drank so much that I couldn't do a show. I never drank on stage. If I was doing a movie, I knew all my lines. I knew all his lines. I knew all their lines. I was totally functional. So nobody saw a problem. Nobody around me was going, hey, you know, he missed a show last night and, you know, he doesn't know his lines and this and that. I was totally functional. In fact, I was better with a little bit of alcohol in me.
It's dangerous.
Yeah, that was the danger. And I never got a hangover. So
very dangerous.
Yeah, so, I mean, I was like, and who's my best friend? Keith Moon. that's a prescription right there for, you know, insanity, you know. So, you know, I mean, it was like you were riding this big giant tsunami wave and it just kept getting better and better. What was happening inside, though, was I was starting to collapse inside physically. But it's okay because another drink will make me feel better. Okay, I finally got to a point where I'd get up in the morning and throw up blood.
Ooh.
And
not that, theatrical blood, real no, blood.
That's when my wife took me by the ear and said, let's go. And I was in the hospital. No, I haven't had a drink now for 30 years. So, you know, that's why I'm still here. But I mean, if I would have kept drinking, two more weeks, I would have been gone.
Whoa.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I lived my life to the fullest at that point. And somehow, you know, God said, that's enough for you. Boom. Take it away.
You mentioned Keith Moon and you've mentioned a love of the Who. Before, we've got to play a Who track. What would you choose?
Oh, yeah. Well, let's play I'm a Boy by The Who.
Why that one?
Because it's kind of like Alice Cooper. I'm a boy, but my mom won't admit it. You know, it kind of, there was something about that song that kind of connected up with me. In fact, I think I did that with when they did The Who at Carnegie Hall. They wanted me to do a couple songs, and I said, let's do I'm a Boy.
Yeah. Your career dipped a bit in the late 80s. Was that almost a relief to kind of go, okay, I've
that's
just got a
when
bit
I went
of
time, in the hospital.
Bit of time.
Yeah, that's when I went in the hospital. That's when I went in. And I was, at that point, drinking myself to death. And the only thing you heard on the radio was disco, which was driving us crazy.
Which wasn't helping.
And it's funny now, I like those songs. But as soon as I got sober, I had to play Alice then for the first time in my life, sober.
Difficult?
I walked a circle. I must have worn a hole out in the carpet the first show. I said, I'm going to go out there. What if Alice doesn't show up? I'm totally sober now. I looked at the old Alice and I said, that Alice was a victim. He was drinking. He was a victim. He was a society's whipping boy. He was, and that's why kids liked him, because he was representing them. I said, this new Alice is going to be a villain. And so now Alice was a dominatrix. And the audience was his little slave. And that was the way I play him now.
When did you first decide to return to Christianity?
Well, no, my dad was a pastor. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Christianity. It was when did I decide to come back to it?
Yeah.
When Alice Cooper came along, it took me as far away as I could get from, in fact, I was the poster boy for everything that church stood for. Mm-hmm. And then got to a point where I realized that I was out in a world that was unsatisfying. I mean, I was married to the greatest girl in the world. I had all the money I ever needed. And I went, what is this all about? What is the final, you know, payoff here? And I realized it wasn't this. It was the fact that I needed to get back to my relationship with Christ. And that was what was really eating away at me. It might even have something to do with the drinking. I was trying to fill that hole with alcohol, you know. When I finally came back to the church and I understood that I was really being called back to it and became a Christian, was baptized. I read the Bible twice a day, teach Wednesday morning Bible study in Phoenix. And honestly, now I feel like I am where I belong. Now, there's a lot of heavy right-wing Christians that might say, how can you be Alice Cooper and do this? Well, I don't live the lifestyle that Alice Cooper used to live. I live a lifestyle that hopefully is pleasing to God. And I asked these people up front, I said, look, I'm not trying to be controversial with you, but if I were playing Macbeth, would that be okay? And they would, of course, it's, you know, Shakespeare. And I go, wait a minute. Macbeth is about murder, incest, witchcraft, everything that the church doesn't believe in, but it's Shakespeare, so it's okay. I said, now, what is the difference between what I do on stage doesn't come close to Macbeth as far as, you know, what is vile in this world. It's come and see my show and tell me if there's anything in my show that's anti-Christian. And they have to come and they understand that it is a lot of fun. My show is like horror, comedy, and music. But there's nothing in there that's anti-Christian.
Another first I have to ask you about was your first round of golf.
Yeah, well, that was another alcohol induced thing. I had hit a golf ball before when I was drinking, just in because I had nothing to do. When I stopped drinking, I woke up sober and I had all day to do nothing. And I said, the first thing I'm going to do is probably start reaching for something. I better go do something. Better get up and go do something. So I went out, went to a golf course, and I said, what do I do? And I picked up the club. He said, hold it like this. Okay. Took it back and I hit a 7-iron dead down the middle. And that's I went like this. I went, that was semi-sexual, you know, because it was solid, solid with a little draw on it, you know? And I went, oh, I could do this. And I was addicted. I played golf 36 holes a day for a year with a pro every day. So by the end of the first year, I was a 9 handicap. Now I play every day. I still play every single day.
The love affair is there.
Oh, I was addicted. And my wife, who teaches ballet, she says, I love ballet. She said, but, you know, I get tired of it once in a while. I said, I never get tired of golf. I said, I could play every day. 18 holes a day is normal for me. That's just like waking up.
Brilliant. For us over in the UK, especially Poison marked your kind of big return.
Yeah.
It was a combination of Poison and a combination of Wayne's World.
You're poison. I don't wanna break these chains.
Can you remember first reading the Wayne's World script and going, oh, this is interesting, this kind of...
Well, Mike Myers called me up, and he knew that I had acted before. He knew I'd done a few films, and so I could act. And he says, we needed somebody that had that prestige of being We're Not Worthy, you know, the sort of the rock icon, and somebody that could handle lines, you know, straight-faced. And so when I got there, we were just supposed to do the song. And Michael hands me about 5 pages of dialogue, and he goes, could you do these lines? We just wrote this. I went, sure. I said, well, when are we shooting it? He said, about a half an hour. And I'm going, Milwaukee, Algonquin. I'm trying to read all this stuff. Time to shoot. So when it came down, I had the basic pattern for what was going to happen. But when it got into the details of the, you know, socialist governors and all this stuff, I was winging it. Every take was a little bit different, but it worked, you know. So Michael at the end goes, that was great, you know, because it sounded like Jeopardy.
We've had all these firsts, and we're going to end on the last, which is the last song that we're going to play, and that's a song that you can choose. It can be something of yours. It can be something that you've always loved. It can be...
Let's play...
Anything you want.
A song that every time I hear it, I go, that's what rock and roll's about. How about Train Kept a Rollin' by the Yardbirds?
What is it about that song that you love so much?
If you don't get up on that song, there's something wrong with you. You don't have a heartbeat.
Then we'll play it. Thank you very much. It's been really good to speak to you.
Great. Thank you, man.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Grace under pressure. is BBC Radio 6 Music. Right now.
This is the Morning After Mix.
You're about to hear a shortened version of the Morning After Mix, a carefully curated playlist available in the BBC Sounds app. It's full of gentle songs for when you need a musical rescue or escape. To find the full version, just search Morning After in the app. But for now, enjoy the calm.